This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I'm going to address something else. Shawn Michaels. After all the crap he said about Canadians last week, you know, it's bad enough what he says about me. And it's bad enough what he says about my family and the Hart Foundation. But you better apologize to the Canadian fans for the trash that came out of your mouth. And you better do it for your own health and welfare. Last week, I said the United States of America was one big, giant toilet bowl. If you were going to give the United States of America an enema, you'd stick the hose right here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You know why? Because you're the piss.
SummerSlam Rewind Series. Today we're going to look at 1997 SummerSlam, and to do that, I have Chris Zellner on the line. How you doing, Chris?
Good. About you, Steve?
I'm pretty good. Oh yeah, I'm Steve. I'm the host of the Pro Wrestling Super Show here on Place to Be Nation. You can check it out here on Place to Be Nation or iTunes or SoundCloud. Chris, why don't you tell everyone about kind of your side projects?
Well, let's see. I do the Lucha Reports for Death Valley Driver, Lucha World, featured in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter, all that good stuff. Pro Wrestling Only, I'm there all the time posting good stuff, part of the 80s Project, all that jazz.
All good stuff for sure. And we also have Charles on the line. How you doing, Charles?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Pretty good. Thunderstorms here, which is always good, so hopefully the power doesn't go out.
Yeah.
And why don't you let everyone know about your podcasts and stuff that you're into?
Sure. I do a podcast called Wrestling with the Past. We haven't done any new episodes in a long time because real life intervened and I became a dad and I didn't know my elbow from my eyeball for a few months, but things are starting to settle back down. So I think we'll get back in the habit of doing some shows again fairly soon. Awesome. So look for that. Those are hosted at Place to Be Nation. I'm also the admin and owner of ProWrestlingOnly.com, which is, you know, I'm not speaking from a place of bias, but I do think it's a pretty great message board. It's filled with if not blank then blank threads. So if that's your thing, then you'll find a comfortable home at Pro Wrestling Only. Also, I'm working on a project which will probably be finished sometime around spring of next year. Walking through the 1990s, looking at it on a global scale. I'm going to release an ebook that will be a collection of what I see as the 500 best matches of the decade from all over the world, along with some interesting sidebar stories and news stories and some deeper looks at some of the big characters and major players in 1990s wrestling. So it's a big project. It's looking to be, I mean, I've already written about 60,000 words and I'm only up to like half of 1992, so it's going to be pretty big, but at this point I'm hoping it'll be ready by April or May of next year.
Awesome. And you should be really at home for this show because I have a few of those if not who type questions, and also this show took place in the 90s,
so that's, yes it did.
So there's two things right there. So I think where we should start is kind of what our experiences were at the time that this show happened, whether we watched it, whether we were following the product, or when we actually saw it for the first time. So why don't you go ahead, Chris?
Well, this was during the time period where I was pretty much alternating out pay-per-views. I didn't order every show at that time because, you know, ECW was on pay-per-view at the time, and the WCW and WWF, so it's kind of like you're picking and choosing. And I decided to pick, I guess it was Road Wild that year. That was in 97. Was it Road Wild yet, or was it still Hog Wild?
Yeah, it was Road Wild. It was the following Saturday, actually, after the show.
Yeah, I decided I'll order that show instead. And looking back in retrospect, that was a mistake. But at that time, I was still partial to WCW, I guess, because of, you know, it's the whole local thing. And very rarely did I pick a WO show of WCW. But, yeah, I mean, I was following the product. I was watching about, again, I was watching more Nitro than Raw, but you could tell from in that time period that Raw was starting to catch on. You know, the whole product was getting hot. You know, Austin was getting his peak, getting ready to his peak, and the whole Bret angle was going strong. So, yeah, they were starting. Although, this show in itself was kind of like, you know, it was a hybrid in a way of what the past was and what the future was going to be. It was all mixed in together. We'll talk about it during the show, but it was an interesting show.
Oh, that's for sure. And what was going on with you in 1997, Charles?
Interesting story. This was actually the summer before my senior year of high school. And I had gone to this program that I was part of for like 6 weeks that summer. It was called Governor School. It's hard to explain what it was, but basically we were studying like 20th century philosophy and a bunch of avant-garde stuff for 6 weeks. And it was like the state-sponsored thing. Bill Clinton started it when he was governor of Arkansas, believe it or not. So it was this really cool experience, but I'd only been home for about a week when SummerSlam happened. So I hadn't really, during that 6 weeks, actually, I logged onto a computer on campus because it was held at like a local college, just to see what was going on because we didn't have any TVs or anything. And that was the first time I had ever looked at wrestling on the internet. So I see that while I'm gone that like Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels had this big fight backstage, and I'm thinking, oh, that must have happened on Raw. Like, I didn't get that that was not an angle, that was something that really happened. And then there were a few other stories that came up like that along the way. But yeah, so when I came back, like I was kind of disconnected from the WWF just because I'd been reading about it, but I kept reading all this stuff about Dude Love, and I'm like, who is Dude Love? Like, why is he a tag team champion with Steve Austin? So I really was, you know, still out of it at this point. I caught on quickly. I think the first time I actually watched an episode of Raw was the night after the show. And, like, it just floored me that anyone would ever boo someone as good in the ring as Shawn Michaels. But so that was kind of where I was at the time. I'm in the same boat as Chris in the sense that I got Road Wild that Saturday also. And that probably between the two was not the best choice. This was the better pay-per-view that month. Although Hardcore Heaven might have been an even better one because that Jerry Lawler, Tommy Dreamer match was pretty great. And that
PG-13
tag too.
Yeah, the Dudley's PG-13, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get to that on our Extreme Vault series at some point. Hopefully coming up. But in 1997, I was 16 years old, so of course I kind of knew everything, and that's when I was like probably my peak of WWF fandom, at least. Like, we were watching every Raw. Nitro in the States didn't really come to Canada until like 98, so you kind of just read about it on the internet, and of course we didn't have pay-per-view, so we kind of had to wait till they came to the video store and watch them that way. But I was reading the results of this one. I didn't really get to watch it at the time, but I was so into the WWF at the time, and it actually came at a very interesting time because the year before was the 96 Olympics when Donovan Bailey became the world's fastest man. He won the world record, the 100-meter dash. There was like this huge Canadian kind of like patriotism and kind of like, you know what, America, we're just as good type of thing going on. We felt kind of redeemed from the Ben Johnson thing. And then, I don't know if you remember, they had a square off between Donovan Bailey and Michael Johnson, who won the 200 meters.
I remember that.
Yeah, and I don't know what your view of it in the States was, but in Canada it was Donovan Bailey was crushing him, and Michael Johnson faked an injury halfway through and pulled out and couldn't even finish the race. At least that was the view in Canada at the time, because we were getting pretty pumped up about Canada at the time, and Lennox Lewis was like the boxing champion. There was all this stuff going on, and then you had Bret Hart go out there and kind of just talk about that kind of stuff, about how great Canada was. And it wasn't even like, you know, kind of like, this is great. It was like, hey, we have healthcare, so what the hell's wrong with you guys type of thing. So it was very interesting time being a 16-year-old really into the product, being really into Canada, and having this main storyline with basically putting down the States. It was a very interesting time going on. What was your kind of... Because I know from all my friends, we were all Canadian, and I know what our kind of point of view was on the Canadian-American feud. What was the thoughts going on in the States, Chris?
It was entertaining, but I think more people here was kind of interested in the whole Bret-Shawn dynamic than the... you know, the whole U.S.-Canadian dynamic more than anything else, you know, at that time. That got more interest, at least I thought.
Charles?
Yeah, I actually, it took me a long time to get on board with Steve Austin, because I didn't understand why anyone would cheer him. and so I was still, I mean, I don't know that I necessarily agreed with everything he said at the time, but I was still a Bret supporter. I don't think that that's probably reflective of most people that were watching, but I just felt like Austin, like, attacked people from behind, and, like, how do you cheer someone that doesn't attack people head on? I remember that being kind of my point of view at that point in time.
Oh, yeah.
And like Chris, I was probably more interested in Bret Shawn than Austin, because it did take Austin. I mean, that's easy to forget just because he's this huge icon, but I mean, his rise to the top was slow and very organic. And in fact, if you watch WWF television in 1997, you actually see a slow increase every single week for about 8 or 9 months. And then just one day you just realize, wow, this guy is a megastar. But it wasn't something that happened overnight at all.
Oh yeah. Like here.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, with Bret, you know, the shift went completely off Austin, you know, after pretty much Canadian Stampede, you know, and went back to Shawn and Undertaker then, and then it never went back to Austin and Bret. You know, Austin and Bret was done as a pretty much a feud. So, yeah, people forget about that, you know, that in the summer of that year, Austin shifted over to Owens and the injury, which we'll talk about, and then the whole thing with Vince started up, and that's when Austin got hot. When he got red hot, that's when him and Vince started going at it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was, we'll talk about it later on, but he was so over on this show, even. Like, it was starting. And I know here he was, like, it was really well hated, because you'd see him, like, attack Bret from behind for no reason, even when Bret was a babyface, and you're just like, what the hell? Like, why are Americans cheering this guy? I was with Charles at that time, for sure. But I think, let's kind of... just kind of dive into the show here. So it starts with a kind of this weird video package about how nothing's fair, which was interesting. I think the most like ridiculous thing was like, why is it fair that Shawn Michaels is the referee? But we'll talk about that later, I guess, about Shawn Michaels as a referee. But it starts off with the American National Anthem, which doesn't usually get played outside of WrestleMania, but it was played here because you would think it's kind of like this big American patriot thing, but it wasn't like WrestleMania 7 or something like that. It didn't feel like a big American patriot show.
It played all part into the Bret thing. That's what it all was about.
Yeah, for sure. So the first match is it's Mankind versus Triple H in a cage. And Triple H, this is back before he was Triple H. He was still Hunter Helmsley, and he was back with China. And he had just won the King of the Ring, and Mankind had just kind of turned face by doing those interviews with JR. Do you have any comments on those, Charles?
Well, yeah, I thought the opening video package was fantastic, and it really kind of showed like the various ways to interpret who the good and bad guys were in the main event scene at that point in time. Like, it really got over kind of the ambiguity of the storylines, and I thought the inflection in the narrator's voice was fantastic. Like, I was really impressed. Like, they've done flashier and like kind of more cutting edge videos, but I really thought this one was excellent.
It was interesting because, like, what I found really interesting, outside of like the stories and kind of portraying them, and like anyone could be kind of the bad guy, and any guy could be the good guy in this. But I found it interesting. It focused on one match. This was the main event. Nothing else was important. If you see video package nowadays, it looks at 2, 3, 4, 5 matches. But this one was all about one match. I really like that as a focus. Any comments on that, Chris?
Well, all the videos on this show was done fairly well. You know, they were starting to come into their own on the production side of things with these video packages at this time. And I try to remember who the narrator was. It was a guy they used a lot in that time period. I used to know his name, and I can't remember it. But, they did a good job. Foley at this time was definitely starting to turn the corner as far as a performer, you know, because he was doing Dude Love and Mankind, and Cactus Jack was about to start back up again. So he was starting to find himself, and Hunter was starting to find himself at this time too. You know, he went King of the Ring, and he had become a pretty strong worker by this time. And the China character was starting to get big. So yeah, I was surprised. You know, this was the first match of the show, especially a cage match. You know, you would think that a cage match wouldn't be your opening match.
But, I had the same thought. Yeah.
But
you look at the rest. Yeah, go ahead, Charles.
Oh, what I was just thinking is, at the time, they still had to set up the cage old school style, so it kind of made sense to have it set up during the intro, and then it's set up, and then you see they had a bunch of, like, packages and all this stuff after the cage, because it takes a long time to set that up.
And I'm trying to remember, was this the last time they had the big blue cage on pay-per-view?
Oh, I was thinking about that, too. I think so. I can't remember another one. Because the new cage debuted, what, in early 99?
They were in Hell in a Cell, you know, and they went to the regular steel cage then, which they never used. You know, and then when they used that for the Hell in a Cell, that's pretty much when they abandoned the big blue cage, because you can't go back to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, in 98, they had something on Raw, I think, between Kane and Mankind, maybe, if I remember right, that was in the new cage, and that may have been the first time.
They had there was a Rock Shamrock Mankind match in a cage in 98 on pay-per-view. But yeah. I don't remember if it was blue or black or what at the time. That was a long time ago now. Any thoughts on the match there, Charles?
I didn't think this was anything more than a decent match, but I really thought the presentation of this whole thing was so good that it almost didn't matter. I liked one thing that's apparent right away is how much Vince was open to ideas that he normally wouldn't necessarily be open to. And I think that's because he was, you know, getting his ass handed to him in a ratings war at the time. And because things like Jim Ross just dropping the historical references right away, mentioning Bruno Sammartino's name, talking about the WWF's history in the Meadowlands, like the fact that he's allowed to do that, I think, it's very out of the box for the WWF, so I thought that was pretty cool. Also, I thought there was great heat for this, and I really liked how they used China for interference. I think they went so long without having China take a bump that when they did something like this, it really worked. It was interesting to me that they did the Hogan Bossman suplex, like as a and not as the finish, and but I think that the finish they did was way better than that could have been anyway. I got a kick out of Jim Ross kind of putting forth his theory that Triple H had a wrestling tutor in Greenwich, Connecticut as a kid. And one thing I think also that makes 1997 WWF unique, and this stood out, the Superfly chants. You don't get those unless people are extremely invested in what they're watching. So, because that, I mean, that was something that was mentioned. I mean, they did push it on television a lot, but it was primarily something that was mentioned in the whole Three Faces of Foley series that they did. So 1997 WWF was not obviously the most profitable year they ever had. It wasn't their biggest business year at all, but I think the level of engagement and passion from the people who were watching, where they were just hanging on to everything and like had a genuine, I guess there was genuine emotion instead of just being excited about what they're watching. I can't think of a year where that's been more apparent. And to me, those Superfly chants really kind of demonstrated that as well as anything.
And I think it had a lot to do with the market too, because they were in the Meadowlands, right, across from New York. So you had that hardcore fan base there. And if you look in the crowd, you see a lot of familiar faces from those shows. Nikolai, what's that his name? Or Vladimir?
Vlad, yeah.
Vlad the super fan. Yeah, Vlad was out there. Hat Guy and his buddy was out there. There was quite a few of the Northeast fans in that area. So you had a smarter group of fans, which is probably one of the main reasons why that chant was so big. Regarding the match itself, the China Bump was important because, you know, they really hadn't done anything with her yet physically like that, where she was getting her comeuppance. And then the whole deal where Foley took his mask off, you know, was a pretty big deal. The fans went nuts for it. And, the match was pretty good, but of course the guard match was the best match of that series, I thought.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then, so we had the finish where, if you look at it, he takes off his mask, he rip opens his shirt, and according to Vince, it reveals a heart on his chest, but it's all faded because he just wrestled the match, and it was like, oh, okay, yeah. You have good vision, Vince. Then he does the dive, and he climbs out for the win, which is pretty good. And then he's lying on the floor, and his music's playing, then it stops, and then the Dude Love music plays. And Vince McMahon goes, he's transforming into Dude Love in front of our eyes.
And His foot started shaking.
And this, I guess, the advantage of having the person who's in charge of the storylines do the announcing, I guess, at this point. Because if this was Nitro with Tony Giovanni, he would have no idea what's going on, I don't think. But what I found really interesting coming out of this feud is, Triple H was supposed to win the King of the Ring in 96, but the click thing happened and it was postponed to 97. So really, they just kind of churned Foley so Triple H would have someone to go over and him become the big star. But looking at this match and what happened afterwards, it's become pretty clear that Foley was the one that became the star out of this, not Triple H. Did you get any feelings like that, Charles?
Definitely, and I think that's the kind of thing. I mean, and I'll throw the same question to you, Chris, actually to both of you. I really think that in his mind, that's the type of thing that caused some resentment from Triple H, because he really felt like he was being put in a position to make everyone from day one. I really think he believes that.
Oh, and, I agree.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
totally.
Yeah. But, you know.
And that goes back to Warrior. You know, the whole thing with Warrior WrestleMania, I think, was a big deal for him to overcome, you know, for a long time in his own mind. You know, that he was the one picked to do that quick job to Warrior. So, and then the whole click thing, hey, he was a product of everybody else's attitudes. So he was the one who got punished because he had no standing in the company, which is funny in retrospect. And to be honest, he's... And I think he knows this. He should thank the Lord for Shawn Michaels, because if Shawn Michaels, if he wasn't friends with Shawn Michaels, who knows how his career would have turned it up? He probably would have been that era of Dolph Ziggler.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
He definitely wouldn't have got that multiple chances, like he got. Like it's ridiculous how many times
he would have been the Buff Bagwell of the WWE.
Yeah. Probably. Oh, well. What can you do at this point? So any other thoughts on this kind of match, or these two guys at this time, or anything like that before we move on?
I think we hit everything.
All right. Yep. So at this point, they're taking down the cage, so they bring out the governor with the headbangers and Gorilla Monsoon.
This was hilarious.
Yes.
This was amazing.
I'm so glad we're talking about this.
I love Vince talking about how the governor's fighting taxes, so she's going to be president one day. I almost said prime minister, but president, because she's the one fighting taxes. I thought it was very funny because it made it seem like the only reason the WWF didn't come to New Jersey was because they were cheap, and they didn't want to pay taxes. But
that's why. They didn't go there for years because of the wrestling tax.
So that's just funny.
It's true.
Charles, what do you think about this whole thing?
Okay, let's talk about Chrissy Todd Whitman. Do you know the story with her with like the photo op and all that? Because we have to mention that.
Oh, I have no idea.
Okay, do you know where I'm going with this, Chris?
You talk about the woman Undertaker?
No, she, and this is actually not wrestling related, but this is kind of in a way what she's most famous for.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead. I know what you're
going to say. Yeah, she went on, I guess for publicity or whatever, she went like on a police ride, and they ended up frisking someone or whatever, and she took a picture of herself frisking like a young African-American teenager,
oops,
like while smiling at the camera, and it caused a huge stir at the time. So she was like kind of an interesting personality in New Jersey politics for sure. But yeah, this segment actually cracked me up because it just reeked of like fat cats and back scratching and palm greasing corruption and just, you know, that there was something going on under the table that wasn't legal. And I also love, and this happens every time in wrestling, you put a Republican out there and Democrat wrestling fans will boo that Republican.
But, you know, the thing is that she was actually a popular governor because Stern was a fan of hers, and Stern, you know, sent her on the air. So yeah, she got a big boost from that, and yeah, before all them other issues came up, yeah, she was fairly popular. She was kind of like the Chris Christie of the '90s, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
You know, on how her popularity kind of started dipping after one stupid move.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, making fun of her, but she was moderate as far as policy goes. Like, you know, but it was just clear that like, I mean, this has happened so many times in wrestling. It's like the people that run wrestling companies tend to be Republican, and so they expect fans to cheer when they bring out Republicans, and they always get booed. We've seen that a few times over the years.
But and one thing about this segment, well, two things. One, Gorilla Monsoon and the Headbangers is quite the threesome coming out to honor her. And secondly, this was by far the best non-wrestling segment on this show, which we'll get to in a minute, because there was one after this that was so horrible that if it happened today, we'll get to that.
Oh boy, so that was fun. And then we have Tiger Jeet Singh and Tiger Ali Singh sitting in the front row.
Yeah. Oh, Tiger Ali Singh, you know, this guy, they were going to push him so hard. He was going to be this huge big deal for the fan base of India, and boy, did he pop. God almighty.
Tiger Jeet Singh does a lot of like good charity work up here in Toronto area, though. So, and Ali Singh, the whole Singh family, they do a lot of nice charity work. They raise some money. They do usually a big show on Canada Day up in their hometown.
He's a big draw.
Yeah.
He's a big draw in Toronto.
He was. Sadly, he was. Yep.
Do they still live the gimmick?
I don't know. I haven't been to any of the things, but I would bet. So I bet he walks around with a sword. He's about a 30-minute drive from where I am, so I don't bump into him or anything. But not like Sweet Daddy Siki, who I see at every wrestling show. So after that, they kind of highlight the beach party that happened earlier. I guess they were still killing time for the cage to come down. I don't know. It seemed like a fun little thing in the parking lot. Any thoughts on that one, Charles?
No, not really.
They had a giant, like, ballooned Undertaker thing. That was pretty cool.
Well, you had Michael Hayes, or at that time, Doc Hendrick, you know, was up there wearing Docker shorts and a button-up shirt, which was funny. And Ross talking about Doc being a free bird up there, which, again, goes into that whole thing about Ross. Ross was, on this show, was just throwing out all kinds of stuff. You know, it was hilarious. But, yeah, you can see from that when Austin, they showed Austin up there, that he was, you know, the fans was loving him. Then you got Shawn Michaels on top of the limousine doing his little pose and all his shtick. So, yeah, that was the highlight of that whole thing.
I just want to throw this in with Jim Ross. It wasn't on the show, but it's my favorite obscure Jim Ross thing around this time. I forget which pay-per-view it was on, but he actually cited a Pro Wrestling Illustrated headline where Kerry Von Erich called Sid Vicious the toughest opponent he had ever faced in a Sid match. and I don't remember what show. It was in 97, I know. It was around this time. So I think Sid was gone by this point, so it had to have been a few months before that. But that was my favorite, like, wow, they're just letting Jim Ross say every single thing that he wants to say moment.
Well, you know, it was a war. You had to fight back any way you could, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and there were two, you know, we talked about the mixture of old and new. Hillbilly Jim and the Honky Tonk Man were shown as appearing at that event. So
yeah, they were.
That's the thing I was talking about, how there was this weird deal going on where you had the old generation and the new generation kind of mixed in together. And there was another instance coming up later.
Yeah, earlier in the year, they were trying to, I guess, audition Honky Tonk Man as a color commentator. He did a bunch of Raws. He wasn't very good, so I'm not sure if that's why he left or because he's the Honky Tonk Man. But they were definitely trying a bunch of weird things.
Well, Rockabilly. You know, that's
the deal. I forgot about Rockabilly.
Did you guys ever get the feeling that Vince would roll out those guys somehow in his mind, thinking that maybe people would see it as the equivalent of, like, all the old WWF stars on Nitro?
I hope so.
I mean, I don't think he saw it to that extreme, but I really do think that's why guys like that and the Iron Sheik or whatever got spots. So I could just see him thinking, oh, if people want retro, we could give them retro.
But I think it was more Vince always doing that, though. Vince always brought people back. It's just the way he's always been. And those were about the biggest names at the time that he could bring back, because all the other guys were on the other side.
I remember, like during that time, Jimmy Snuka was treated as this Bruno or Hogan level legend by the WWF around this time.
Well, it's the biggest star they had they could actually bring in.
Now, Ivan Plesky was back, you know, when Scott was.
Oh, yeah, he was. He came back a couple months after this, yeah. That's ridiculous. And Lou Albano was in the front row somewhere, too.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Yeah, that was a whole other... When that match... We'll talk about that match. That's a whole other thing.
Okay. So I guess let's move on to the Goldust-Pillman match. What happened was, on this show, Bret Hart earlier, he said that if he couldn't win the title, he would never wrestle in the States again. And they made it a part of his contract. And then every member of the Hart Foundation made some kind of weird side bet like that. So Brian Pillman, in this one, he said if he lost this match, he'd wear a dress the next... Marlena's dress, I think, the next show, next on Night on Raw. So that's what the kind of the storyline of this one was. The weird thing, actually, we'll bring it up now. So they each made this bet, and Jim Neidhart said if any of the Hart Foundation members lost, he would shave his beard. And then he disappeared from TV, and he wasn't on this show, and he didn't come back for a couple more months. So does anyone know what happened with Jim Neidhart? Did they originally think the Hart Foundation was going to win every match, or did he originally think he was going to shave his beard, then chickened out, or what happened with him?
I don't really know. I just
I can't remember.
If Blank wins, then the loser has to do this is such a way that you know Jim Cornette is booking. Because that is such a Jim Cornette thing to do. I mean, he's always been obsessed with that. And, you see it in huge numbers on this show. I noticed that, too. Like, it seemed like every match had something like that.
Yeah, they were all trying to...
Staple.
Yeah, because there was all the stable members, yeah.
It's just Jerry Jarrett right there, all the way.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it paid off. It added a little bit of intrigue to some of these undercard matches that might have not had intrigue. But so we had this match, and Brian Pillman comes out, and you notice he was wearing a Marilyn Monroe t-shirt. That was pretty cool. I don't know where he found that. And he had a little promo before the match. Did anyone catch that one?
I can't remember what he said, but
me neither.
Pillman at that time was just a wild character. And another guy, man, he was starting to come into his own, and it's just the sadness of him, you know, dying at the time he did was just terrible.
It's too bad they couldn't have, like, made him just as, like, a manager and not wrestle, like, kind of like a Bobby Heenan type of guy, and not try to get back in the ring, just kind of be that crazy man on the outside that takes occasional bumps. He was so great at that.
Yeah, but I think he wanted it.
Yeah.
And they weren't going to stop him, because at that time, they were blind to all the stuff that, you know, could happen. It was a different time in the sport, so... Yeah, the attitudes wasn't what they are now.
Yeah. The other kind of thought I had about this match is, how great would this match have been 2 or 3 years ago? Like, Charles, what do you think?
Yeah, definitely it would have been better in a different time, because Pillman had slipped so much by this point. My favorite part of this match was Jerry Lawler saying he had never struck a woman in his life. We've seen Memphis wrestling. We know that to not be true at all. But really, with this match, because the match wasn't much. I mean, Pillman just didn't have it anymore, but... This just reminded me how this is probably the one feud in 1997 WWF that I absolutely hated. This was my least favorite feud, I think, of the year. If I would have been an Observer subscriber and worst feud of the year would have been something I was voting on, then I probably would have voted this. Just because, and this isn't something that they hadn't gotten to this point yet, but the idea of putting up your wife in a match is just something I could never get past.
Well, my worst... You know, oh, go ahead.
That whole deal with Dustin, with them humanizing the Goldust character, pretty much killed the character. And then you had the constant mention of Dusty Rhodes, who is on the other show. You know, and especially in this match where Lawler called him Old Dust. And yeah. Then you had JR, you know, mentioned him by name numerous times. Talk about the flip flop and fly. Also, and it's like this guy is your competition, prominent a member of your competition announce team, and you're mentioning him throughout the match. And the fact that they, you know, acknowledge he's Dustin Rhodes, also it killed the character in my opinion at that time. It really did.
Yeah, it was. I don't know. It kind of works nowadays. Him kind of more humanized, but back then, yeah, just although he was very floundering. Before they did this in early 97 as kind of as a babyface character, didn't really work back then until they kind of figured it out later on. I'm not sure what they could have done to keep it kind of edgy as a babyface.
I will say this though, when they, I think it was very smart, and I would actually, if I had to guess, I would actually probably credit this to Vince Russo, and you won't hear me say that very many times, but the segment that they did, like, kind of starting as this overly sappy, like ridiculously over sappy, until Goldust like snapped at Terry and said, "This interview's over. I'm done with you." Like, I thought that was great because we'd gotten so used to such like sappy looks at them. Like, how many times did we hear the words "Young Dakota"
yeah.
on television in 1997? So that I thought was a nice twist, and I really do think like that weird bondage S&M Goldust era is something that's largely been forgotten that I thought was tremendous in like late
90s. It was definitely entertaining. That there's no doubt about that, and it's something that, you know, it's fairly memorable to me. I thought it was pretty wild television for that time, but I could see where a lot of people would have got turned off by that.
Do you remember, I think it was on the DX pay-per-view, when he deadpanned Green Eggs and Ham while he was, like, being gagged? And
Yeah.
And then he was, like, Baby New Year, like, a couple weeks later. Yeah, that was ridiculous.
But if they're going to humanize Goldust and turn him, you know, and have him out there as Dustin Rhodes, then have him out there as Dustin Rhodes at that time. The fans weren't, I don't think, were ready for a guy to be in and out of gimmick. You know, you're either a gimmick or you're not. You know, it's hard for me to see you as Dustin Rhodes here 1 second and Goldust the next second. And yeah. It's just, now you can do that, back then you could.
Yeah, that's a good point, for sure. It was a weird time, because you had Mankind flipping between two gimmicks, too. So it was just this weird kind of thing going on all around.
Yeah, he got it over, though, because every character was different, and it was all Foley. You know, it all had the Foley touch to it. So he made it work. Dustin just couldn't at that time.
And really, Foley kind of... I mean, I don't think anyone would agree that over time Mick Foley humanized himself way too much. But at that point, yeah, it was still new and fresh, and he hadn't gone too far at all. And plus, I think this is also important. I mean, even for people who'd been watching him for years, that was really the first time, unless you watched some ECW, that you got to see Mick Foley's sense of humor.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Because he's always such a psychotic character. You know, that now you're seeing the different layers of Foley. And I think what got Foley was Beyond the Ring. You know, when that came out, everybody's perception of him pretty much changed, mainly, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the one that really worked for me on Foley was the night after the King of Ring, where China told him to come here and kiss his ass. And he's like, it's your lucky day because I'm a good kisser. Like, that line with me cracked me up so much. He won me over there.
I still love the when they were in Madison Square Garden and the "Are you thinking what I think you're thinking?" and then "I think I am thinking what you think I think you're thinking."
Yeah, that was good too. Oh man!
But one thing we got to talk about the Goldust match is the paint job.
Yeah, that was
paint
weird.
Paint was all over the place in this match.
I like that. Lawler said that Pillman looked like a baboon with the paint on his face.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why he couldn't find paint that didn't come off everywhere. I don't know what he was using at the time. But what can you do? I don't know. This match, I guess, ends. Marlena interferes with her purse. Pillman has to wear a dress the next night on Raw, and this storyline continues on from there in a very weird manner, as Charles pointed out earlier. Anything else on this one? It's kind of a short little...
We did it.
Yeah. So let's move on here. We got the heel Godwins coming out without Hillbilly Jim with Confederate flag. And they're taking on LOD. And I guess it's kind of a revenge match where LOD broke Henry Godwin's neck and now he's coming back for his revenge. And this match was very, very strange to me because there was this whole line talking by the commentators how LOD... accidentally broke their neck last match, and this match they're going to intentionally break his neck. And it's pro wrestling where you're trying to hurt your opponent at all times. So it's just a very weird kind of thing going on. What did you think of this one, Charles?
Yeah, this was awfully weird. I don't have a ton to say about it. I did like the spike pile driver as a finish, just because that's not really a finish you see very often. So I thought that was kind of cool, like context issues aside. But one thing that also stood out to me is that Henry Godwin is probably better than he may have gotten credit for. But I mean that more in like a ring general way and like kind of keeping a match going more than like that he was doing something dynamic that caught your attention. But I think he was good as a ring general, and I kind of picked up on that a little bit. Even though the match wasn't that great, it seemed like he was the one kind of calling everything.
Yeah, I liked him a lot better as a heel. They kind of seemed like a roughhouse tag team. They seemed like a lot more entertaining. Not super entertaining, but more entertaining than the the face dancing hog farmers. What do you think about that, Chris?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of those two. You know, I went to all the, you know, the tapings back in the day at Center Stage, and the old Texas Lassinger and Shanghai Pierce was cult heroes of Center Stage in that era, man. The fans loved them, even though they were heels, because they were so good as a team in the ring, you know, even though they never really got pushed, You know, they were always in good matches because they were always good. And of course, Henry Godwin was Shanghai Fierce. And, they under a mask. So, yes, I always had a soft spot for those two. This match is another way of telling, you know, the old and new, because the Godwins were still fairly young at that time. You know, Henry was never the same after that neck injury. But, and the Road Warriors were still looking like the Road Warriors of 1987, not 1997. So, you know, it was that time where, okay, you know, maybe it's time these guys kind of, you know, started going down. I guess you could say they were going down the food chain, but, you know, it wasn't as extreme as it would get, as embarrassing as it would get the next year when Russo ruined them. But, yeah, it was interesting to watch. And the whole Confederate flag deal was, you know, something that, you know, I thought it was a cool touch, because they added to their gimmick as being these tough rednecks, heel rednecks at that, not just the cool farmers. And, you know, they ditched their shirts now, they're straight overalls. So, yeah, I thought those guys had something, but, you know, the injuries caught up to them.
You know who the Godwins remind me of, actually, around this time? Have you ever seen Paradise Lost?
No.
Yeah.
The guy in the second one that they thought may have been the one who killed the boys. You know what I'm talking about, Chris? Yeah, he feels like he would be like a great Godwin.
Well, the Godwins, you know, you could really say it's the modern day Wyatts. You know, the comparison, you know, Rowan and Harper to them, and it's a good comparison. Rowan and Tex Lassinger were Phineas Godwin. They're about as comparable as workers, and Godwin and Henry Godwin and Luke Harper were the workers of the team. So, it was like the Wyatts of 1997.
Maybe. I think Luke Harper is quite a bit better than Henry Godwin. I don't know about you, Charles.
Yeah, I think he's better, but I still think Chris's analogy works, just in terms of comparing the dynamic between the two teams.
Oh, yeah, the dynamics for sure.
That's dynamic, not just a total, like, worker.
Okay.
Henry Godwin was not doing so based before and stuff like that. But, you know, the whole dynamic is where I was getting at.
Oh, yeah.
And also, during this match was Lou Albano. Yeah, we got to talk about that. Lou Albano was sitting ringside, you know, an old relic of the past. And Vince made a comment on the announcing something about how, is Lou Albano out here scouting a future team, you know, that he's going to manage? Like, we just had this happen with him a couple years ago with the head shrinkers, and now you want to bring him back again? So they were so confused at where they wanted to go at this time. It was funny to watch.
Yeah, well, Lou Albano's managed, 24 tag team champions? Of course he'd be out there scouting. Yeah, it's weird. And, like, earlier in the year, they had Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson out there with The Rock as a babyface. Yeah, it was... This year is kind of, like, just all over the place, throw anything at the wall and see what sticks type of year. So I think... not much else to say about that match, but I think at this point we have Chris's favorite segment, which was the $1 million challenge.
Oh, yes.
I'll just let you talk about that a little bit.
They had this contest going at a time when they were giving away $1 million. And it was something involving Discovery Zone, which is a relic of the 90s. And you had these two people that flew in and all this stuff up there, and they had a bunch of keys, opened up this coffin of money, the way it looked like. And Todd Pettengill, which was this his last show? I think this may have been his last big show in the company. Michael Cole debuted on this show. So, I think this was Todd Pettengill's last show in the company, or one of them. And he was up there with Sable and Sonny, who, you know, you could tell at the time who was the one that was about to push hard, and it was Sable. Although Sonny was it was still the top woman in the company. Sable was going to take her spot. But anyway, they're up there trying to dial the telephone to call these people to trying to get the key number to open up the coffin. And how many people did they call and not get an answer? I think it was maybe three.
Yeah,
maybe
something
four.
Like that.
And so they finally got somebody to answer the phone. And of course, the key they used wasn't the key. And then there's two guys up there. One was a younger kid and a middle-aged guy. Sonny was rubbing his shoulders and rubbing his back. You know, that guy was just going crazy inside, I'm sure. And he couldn't get it open. And the kid couldn't get it open. And this is just a humongous waste of time. If this happened today, the reaction on the internet would be volcanic, I think, if this happened on a pay-per-view now. And it would just be insane. Meltzer would just be totally shitting on this. Twitter would just be going crazy. You know, it'd be a show killer. But it seemed like it went forever. It had to go 10 minutes at least, maybe even longer. And I could be wrong on that, but it felt like it went an hour. But it was just horrible live television, man. And if I had been sitting there at the time, and I can't remember how much they were charging for their views back then, but I was like, my God, I spent this money for this? They could have had a match, you know, in this amount of time. That would have been a million times better than this segment. I mean, if you're going to do something like this, you know, do it backstage or, you know, do it where you can tape it for live. But my God, it was horrible.
What I found really interesting, you brought up Meltzer on his reaction and what it would be nowadays. The last WWF pay-per-view, the Battleground, he, on his live review, was ranting about how much time they were wasting. I'm like, compared to this, they were they were using great use of their time, for sure. The other thing I found interesting, it was on PWO. I'm not sure what thread it was or who said it, but they made a point that the people backstage watching this segment, they decided that Sable should be the one that should be the superstar based on this segment, because I have no idea why. Like, because this, like, Sable was, like, completely devoid of charisma, while Sonny, like, at least she had a personality. Sable was just, like, a robot out there. I don't know, do you have any thoughts on this one, Charles?
I thought the exact same thing was how much charisma Sonny had compared to Sable. Just and Sable was so exposed when you saw them next to each other in the same segment. In fact, I thought this, and I actually made a note of this. Maybe we could talk a little bit about Sonny's problems in WWE, which, and I'm not talking about like the stuff like the ribs, like with her sandwich where she was sent home. I'm talking more about her attitude and how it sometimes worked against her, because I really think her biggest problem, more than anything else, was that she understood wrestling a little bit too well. And so if she was presented with something and it didn't make sense, then she would rip it to shreds. And she wasn't always polite about doing so. And I think that they weren't used to dealing with someone who was like that, who wasn't like a main event talent.
I think there is a good reason why there was such a long period where they, like, refused to hire any women who had any knowledge about wrestling, and they were just hiring models and stuff. And I think they were, like, from Sonny. I think that kind of, they had that problem, and they're like, well, we just want women to do whatever we want, as sexist as that sounds. But I think they had that kind of feeling. Chris?
Oh, totally. And another thing, I think that with her other issues that she had at the time, I think that played a factor in, of course. And the fact that, you know, yeah, they pushed her extremely hard in this era, you know, into the media, you know, getting her on, like, the shows like Extra and stuff like that back then. And I think a lot of that went to her head. And that was another thing. She had this ego as well that went along with it. Plus the fact that, you know, she had her deal with Brett, and that definitely worked against her, you know, in that whole situation. So, yeah, it was just, you know, a whole bunch of stuff hitting at one time. And Sable was robotic, yeah, at this time period. But she was also, I don't know if she was younger than Sonny. I can't remember what the difference is in age. But, she wasn't putting her stuff all out there. Like, I mean, the outfit that Sunny wore was, her chest was just all over the place. I mean, she could have fell out any second. Sable was in like all black leather, but she was still, I guess you would say, more conservative than Sunny was. So, yeah, Sable was kind of like, you know, she still had that, that thing that you want to see more of her. I mean, you pretty much already seen everything of Sunny, just about.
Yeah, it's like Sable was like the dominatrix where everything is a safe word.
Oh boy.
And then it wouldn't even be a year later when everything, you know, changed. When she became the like Sunny was, but even then though, I mean, she was still getting to make a push.
Yeah, they
because she had the chance to post for Playboy. She took it. Sunny, I think she had a chance and denied it.
Yeah, I think Russo had a big part of pushing Sable.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
and Kevin Dunn, I remember, was a big Sable. I mean, we laugh, but I seem to remember that Kevin Dunn was a really big Sable supporter too.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on from talking about the Million Dollar Challenge and the women to talking about dog food. very natural segue, I think. So we have British Bulldog, I think, might be one of his second or third European title defense against Ken Shamrock. He didn't defend that title very much. And Bulldog's attempt to one-up Bret Hart was to say that if he lost, he would eat a can of dog food, which is a weird thing to put on the line, but that's what he did. So we have his match here against Ken Shamrock. What do you think about this one, Charles?
I realized watching this match that how horribly misused Ken Shamrock was.
Oh, yeah.
He was in this company. Like, this is a guy who should have been, regardless of how good he was in the ring, he should have always been pushed at a main event level. He should have been treated extremely seriously. He never should have been put in situations like this. Like, to me, Ken Shamrock should have been like the Brock of his era, and he wasn't pushed that way at all. And this match just made that even more obvious. I mean, he's doing kind of like an upper mid card comedy match based around dog food with Davey Boy Smith. And when they had something so much more special, I think just between his real life story and between like the tough guy factor, like they had so much they could build on with this guy. And I think they could have made him a superstar kind of under the right circumstances. And so this match just, and another thing, the finish, they did this Shamrock Snaps thing a lot around this time. And I think it actually worked against getting him over. Like, they got over that he was crazy, but they didn't get over that, like, he could win a match, really. they just put him over as the psychopath when the whole thing about Ken Shamrock, like, is that he's, like, this, you know, incredibly tough guy who comes from humble beginnings, and it doesn't really match the way that they presented him when they first brought him in at all.
Well, yeah, this is, I think, one of those things. Like, I know Bret was really high on Shamrock, and I think Bret was losing favor with the company, so I'm not sure if that had a play in it. But I really think, after watching this, like, that get out of my way and suplexing, you know, Gerald Briscoe and Pat Patterson and all those guys, like, it got a huge pop. Like, I think if Austin's pile driver, if he couldn't come back, I think Shamrock might have been a guy they might have had to turn to, because they were running out of guys at that point. But what he was completely misused, but he still could have been salvaged at this point. What do you think about Shamrock, Chris?
Well, he did get his auto shot at the X-ray review. So.
And I mean, wow, Sean sandbag him there.
Yeah, I mean, they eventually did do that. But I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that they didn't want to make it seem like MMA was better than pro wrestling. You know, they didn't want to push this guy who is known for being in UFC and working mixed martial arts and putting him out there, you know, destroying their guys. You know, they wanted to protect their guys to start off with, and make it seem like, you know, let him adapt first, you know, let him, you know, build some credibility in their eyes, you know, working his way up the charts, instead of throwing him in the main events immediately, having him win the championship, blah, 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 blah. I'm pretty sure that was their mindset at the time. But I agree with Charles. I think that Shamrock should have got that push, because you know, there was a big ABC feature at that time where they called him the world's most dangerous man. And, you know, Ken Shamrock had a mainstream name going around. And they could have really had something with him, you know, pushing him against Brett. Or even against Austin or whoever. You know, the opportunity was there. But, the dog food deal, that's all, that's Memphis. You know, Bobby Eaton did that gimmick in 83 with Mad Dog Boyd of the Bruise Brothers, the Mid-South version of the Bruise Brothers with Pork Chop Cash, where if he lost to Mad Dog Boyd, he had to eat a can of dog food, and he did. you know, we never saw, I don't think Bulldog ever actually ate the dog food. I can't remember if he did or not, but the dog food played a prevalent role in this match and in the angle ahead of the match. And it was kind of it was just a nasty looking stuff, man. It looked a stain in the ring. It wasn't as bad as the slop, but it was close enough.
Yeah.
And the finish at the end definitely got over with that crowd because of the Northeast, you know, got into that. And it was kind of different because you never really saw Patterson or Briscoe take bumps at that time. So, and that was pre-Austin doing it every week. So, yeah, it got over what it was.
Yeah, I like, you know, it was a weird match to put him in, but like, you know, Davey Boy was still a relatively big star at the time for the WWF, and, you know, if he bulldozed through him, and he had a match more similar to the match he kind of had with Vader, and kind of kept with that style, I don't know. I think they could have done a lot with him, but I don't know what the problem was. You know, he had a solid, decent career, though, as, like, you know, mid-card level.
I've always had this alternate reality in my head where Bill Watts signs Ken Shamrock to WCW in 1992, but just because I think Bill Watts would be brilliant at getting someone like that over in a wrestling environment, and I picture him like rebuilding WCW and Ken Shamrock's image, and that becoming like kind of a turning point for them. And the timing may not have been right. That's something I've always been curious about. Like, what would Bill Watts have done with a Ken Shamrock? That's always intrigued me.
Would he use him as Ken Shamrock or Vince Torelli?
Yeah.
Oh boy. well, not much else to say about that. So we'll move on. HBK does a quick little promo talking about how he's going to be good job as a referee or something. He's just so hateable at this point. And this is, I guess, a couple hours before he turned heel. But any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I think one thing fans were so excited about was at that time was, you mean we have permission to boo Shawn Michaels now? Like, that's awesome. Like, people were doing it in a lot of cases, and I think there were a lot of people who just weren't because they were giving him, like, the polite response. But it was – I remember in the interviews that he had building up SummerSlam, like, that first one he did in Canada where he had the flags in his shorts.
Yeah.
That was an incredibly heated interview, and that may be – to me, I've always thought that was the best interview that I ever did. Because he just got the crowd so furious at him. And then even, like, the American promos, I mean, they were cheering him more, obviously, than they were in Canada, but you still got the sense, like, ooh, I can tell that something's about to happen, and, like, people were excited, I think, to finally have permission to boo the guy.
I love Shawn Michaels at this time period, actually. as a character, I thought he was highly entertaining. I loved his whole shtick. He was, you know, in the ring, he was really, really damn good. I guess at the time what it was, he, you know, we're an internet fan. You always had this, well, at least I did, and the group of people I knew did. You always had this belief that this guy didn't want to be there. he wanted to meet with his buddies. And he's being held pretty much against his will by a contract, you know, to stay in WWF. So he's going to go out there and just do whatever he wants to do, you know. He's going to, as far as, you know, within the bounds. You know, of course, you know, he's not going to go into business for himself. But when it comes to promos and stuff like that, he's going to do whatever he wants. And it was this unpredictability about Sean. Plus, you know, just the way he dressed. I mean, that Raw where he was out there in the Docker shorts and the brown shirt, wearing house shoes or penny loafers out there. This was that's like, really. I mean, what wrestler is going out wearing this? You know, it was hilarious. And he was just doing stuff at the time that would crack me up. And yeah, I just love Shawn Michaels in this era. Then DX, you know, DX thing started up and took it to a whole nother level. But yeah, I know I can understand why a lot of people hated Shawn Michaels, but I thought he was fucking awesome. And then, you know, the whole thing this was also around the time when the NWO shirt picture showed up. And people were going ape shit online about that. You know, Shawn's wearing an NWO shirt. You know, all these rumors going around that he may show up on Nitro, or he may show up on a pay-per-view, you know, doing something. So he had this buzz about him, this whole aura going on.
I think you can make an argument, a really good argument, that this was the best run of his career.
Oh yeah, I totally agree with that.
I don't know what else compares.
As a performer, I still think that his work in '95, right after he turned, was about as strong as it got for him as a singles guy. I love that era of Shawn Michaels in the ring. As a performer, though, in the '97, yeah, was the best.
Well, so we get to talk about HBK a little bit later, so we'll save whatever we have left. We'll talk about this last final match here before we take a break. And this, Charles talked about Pillman Goldust being his least favorite feud of the year. I'm going to go with the Gang Wars as my least favorite feud of the year. So what we have here is the Disciples of Apocalypse versus the Los Boricuas. So what happened was Farouk fired Crush and Savio from the Nation, and each of them went out and formed their own stable, and they were facing off here. And there's all this weird stuff, like the Puerto Ricans and the Black people were the heels and the white supremacists were the faces, but the white guys never won because that would look racist, so they always lost all their matches. It was a whole weird dynamic, and it was endless, and the matches stunk, even though, you know, the Boricuas had some good guys in it. So I don't know, Charles, what do you have thoughts about this 8-man tag?
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with anything you said. I guess it is probably Gang Wars for me too. I wasn't thinking about that when I thought about Pillman Goldust. And yeah, I mean, that's back to going to that summer where I was gone. Like, that kind of started while I was, you know, away for the summer. But, you know, I came back and kind of see how it was playing out. And yeah, I never quite understood what they wanted us to take away from those segments. Other than that, and not that I say it any better, but like, I couldn't stop laughing at Todd Pettengill saying the word Boricua. but also I felt like, and I don't want to throw this all in his lap because he may have made valid points. He may have been like arguing against it at the time, but Jim Cornette's fingerprints were on WWF stuff at this time. And he's a guy who learned a lesson about like the downside of race baiting just a couple of years before this. And so I do wonder if he, like, supported these segments, if he came up with the idea, if he was fighting them. I don't really know, but I've always been intrigued by that.
Yeah, I thought that I like, you know, Gang Wars type stuff. I love factions, you know, battling each other. I think it's an element of wrestling that we don't get enough of these days. But this one was kind of interesting because you had everything was all stereotypes, you know, from the Nation to the Boricuas and their look, you know, in their convertibles with their their white pants and, you know, that whole Cuban look. And then you had DOA looking like, you know, the Hell's Angels and stuff like that, you know, and the whole white supremacy undertones. It was kind of weird to watch it at times. And, you know, the fans, you didn't really know how to react to a lot of these segments. And, you know, then you had Ahmed Johnson out there who just about messed up, who was it, Chains or Crush at the time, you know, with that Pearl River Plunge on the floor, which wasn't a Pearl River Plunge. the finish was botched. The fans were like, you could hear the fans like yelling some interesting stuff at the Nation in ringside. So it was something, I guess, like to get controversy, you know, at the time. But it never never really worked for me. Although I did like the fact that, you know, you actually got Brian Lee and the Bruce Brothers together, which always was cool to me. For some reason, because, you know, they were like brothers. But, yeah, other than that,
they were brothers.
Dad. Yeah,
Brian Lee.
Yeah, oh. Brian Harris.
Oh, yep. I had no idea.
Yep.
This is why you're a Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame voter, I think.
Yeah.
What I found interesting about Brian Lee here is a couple of years earlier, he played a fake Undertaker, and here he's playing, you know, the white supremacist biker, a gimmick that Undertaker stole 2 years later. So it's just kind of a weird little thing to see. But I don't really have any other things to say about this match before we go to break, Charles?
No.
All right. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today, plus be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, placetobenation.com.
This is the King of Old School, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling. We talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right. The Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
All right. And we're back. And we have the final two matches here to talk on our SummerSlam Rewind of the 1997, the SummerSlam. And what we have here is Owen Hart defending the title against Steve Austin. And I guess the thing Owen Hart was put on the line was the title, but what Austin put on the line to go against what Bret Hart said earlier was, if Owen wins, Austin would kiss Bret's Owen's ass, which I guess was a thing Vince liked to think about a lot, because he later on did the Kiss My Ass Club. But what is your overall, I guess, thoughts about this match? Maybe we'll talk about it before the Tombstone, and we'll talk about it after, Charles.
I thought this was fantastic. I love this match, and I think that gets forgotten because the finish is so notable, and rightfully so, but this match was great. I really loved Owen biting Austin's middle finger and working over his hand just to make this philosophical point about...
the middle finger.
Like, I loved that. And also, one other thing I loved about it was that it was so true to who Owen Hart was and who Steve Austin was. Like, there was nothing in this feud or in this match that felt out of character for either guy. And I really appreciated that. It was like one great crowd-pleasing spot after another. Lots of intensity. It was just... it really was a fantastic match. We can hold off talking about the finish for now because it sounds like you want to come back to that. But I love the body of the match, actually. I think it's one of the better WWF matches in 19.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the fact that they did so much stuff about the neck, you know, about all the past issues with Austin's neck, which Ross mentioned, you know, it was kind of an eerie foreshadowing of what was to come. You know, it was kind of odd watching this match. This is actually this is, I think, the first time I've watched this match. Just, I watched it back then, you know, on the, when I first saw it. And it's like, wow, man, this is kind of wild hearing this commentary about how much they're talking about the neck, considering what's going to happen that later. But, yeah, Austin was starting, like I said earlier, was starting to get hot. And Owen was such a strong performer himself. And yeah, these two, they had a good chemistry against each other, I thought. And Owen was just fantastic in this match. And it's a shame about how, you know, what would happen after the finish would, you know, kind of hurt him in the long run. But we'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah, and I just thought this was tremendous up until that point. Like, just everything I love about wrestling here. You had the neck work later on, but you had the early stuff where Owen was destroying the hand and the finger work with the biting about trying to destroy him so he couldn't give the middle finger anymore, which is so awesome. I loved all that. I wanted to... So we obviously have the tombstone finish here, which injures Austin's neck legit, and they do this really kind of crappy roll-up finish because that's the only thing Austin could do. There's a lot to talk about here. I want to bring up a question. How much do you guys think a crappy finish, whether it's booking, whether it's an injury, whatever it is, how much does that affect an overall match? Because it was pretty amazing for, you know, 15 minutes, and the last minutes kind of sucked.
I don't think that there's a written rule. I think it's kind of a case-by-case basis. And in this case, we're looking at the match, like, retrospectively, and knowing that this is, like, a key part of Austin's ascension to the top, as horrible as that sounds, I actually don't think the finish hurts this in the slightest. Trying to think about it for, in the context of not knowing what's coming after it, it probably did a little bit, but... still, I don't think it was... like, I feel like anyone who rags on this match because of the finish, like, it almost feels a little insensitive in the sense that, yeah, of course the finish was messed up because he just broke his neck. So, you know, like, just give it a rest and just be glad that you got the stuff that you got, you know? Like, it really doesn't... I mean, it wasn't well executed, obviously. I'm not going to pretend that it was, but it doesn't really take anything away from me. Watching the match either.
I just want to... I looked up the star ratings from Meltzer at the time. He gave this 2.75, which I think's a little unfair. So obviously he thought the finish really destroyed the match, I guess. What do you think about that, Chris?
Yeah, I was watching the match and I was sitting here wondering, if that happened in today's wrestling, would they even have to finish the match? Would they actually, you know, stop the match completely and just do some type of no contest? Because, I mean, you know, such a serious injury like that, you know, they would call Doc in and throw the X up and all that stuff. And I think we would not even have finished that match. Different era, different time. We talk about before. And yeah, it was a fluky finish. Owen tried. You know, Owen did a good job considering, you know, and they tried, and Lawler tried to say, well, Owen hit his head on the mat when Austin took him down. So he was, you know, he may have got hurt too, you know, and then Ross was like, well, he was surprised that Austin had it in to do that. But, all, I mean, the finish was bad, but, I mean, you can't, I mean, what can you do? I mean, the dude couldn't do nothing, hardly. So, you know, they had to go home, and that's the way they went home. And, all, you know, the memorable thing about the match, though, at the end was Austin, you know, finally getting up and, you know, still doing his, you know, raising his arm up, you know, the best he could do with the belt, and having to be helped out. But, you know, he was showing this heart that got him over even more with the fans. Like, this guy is a tough bastard. I mean, he almost broke his neck. And, yeah, and Owen, you know, we talked about that a while ago. That finish really hurt Owen because Austin blamed him. He was very hard on Owen Hart for about that. And Owen suffered, you know, for a while for that, you know, happening because of how Austin felt. So, yeah, I mean, it was sad it happened, and all sort of stuff, and it hurt Austin at the time, but it, in the long run, like Charles said, it really, you know, added to his aura. And then when he came back, I mean, he was huge in the whole thing event. But the Meltzer, I can totally see why Meltzer would have been that critical, because of that finish. That's how he is in a lot of ways and stuff like that.
Oh, he hated this show. If you look at the ratings, like, Mankind Triple H got 2.5. Goldust Pillman got 0.5 star. The LOD Godwins got 0.5 star. Bulldog Shamrock got 1.75 stars. The 8-man tag got 0.5 star. And the main event, which we'll talk about in a little bit, got 3 stars. So, like, I've never seen ratings this low out of a WWF pay-per-view before. This is, like, he must have, I don't know, been in a really bad mood that night or something. But
I really think sometimes it's a case of, I mean, like, I won't be too critical of him for that, just because he didn't know what was coming afterwards, and we know, so we are watching with knowledge that he didn't have at that point in time. But at the same time, I do feel like it's a lot of not being able to see the forest for the trees if you penalize a match too much for an injury that was that legitimate. I mean, the fact that Austin was even able to roll him up for a finish, I think, is a credit to both of those guys. Now, one thing that I did want to say is I really feel like, I mean, we were talking about this, if this had happened with your really top guys, your respected guys, like, let's say that the injury happened to a guy that Undertaker was in the ring with, or Steve Austin, or Triple H, or someone that, or Shawn Michaels, or someone else that Vince really holds in that high regard, and they were scheduled to lose the match, I really think that any one of them probably would have called an audible and changed the finish in the match. They would have just pinned them or something. Obviously, I think if Owen had done that here, because of the stipulation, he couldn't do that. The ramifications of him doing that, I mean, that would have been even worse considering what happened, but do you guys agree with me with that? Like, if it was Steve Austin against Owen Hart in when Austin was already at the very top and Owen was the one who got hurt like that, I feel like Austin would have just called an audible and pinned him.
Yeah, I'm not sure so much it was Owen. It was, I think it was more the stipulation. Like, I guess that would look really bad on Austin. I don't know. He could have kissed Owen's butt and still came out as a badass
also,
somehow. Kissed his butt, then gave him a stunner.
Also credit to Owen for trolling the fans during all that. You know, he kept the fans into the match by, you know, chanting Canada and all sort of stuff. So he did a really good job of thinking on the fly there of you know, how to keep the match going without, you know, looking like just complete match confusion.
Yeah, he did do a great job. He's like, now I'm going to make him kiss my butt and all these things. He was killing time really well. The best you can do, I guess, in that situation.
The scariest moment to me is that little, that white line that goes across Austin's back when you see him take that bump.
Yeah.
You know, about, like, around the middle of his back, just like you just see his skin get like white as a sheet. Ugh, like, yeah. Stripe. Yeah, it's pretty hard to watch.
Yeah, for sure. So let's go into some kind of what if type situations here. So, do you think if the pile driver went off flawlessly and Austin wasn't injured, would it have really changed anything for Austin? What do you think, Charles?
Well, Austin, from what I understand, I mean, he obviously had bad knees at this point, but his body, from day one, Steve Austin wrestled a very physical style, and that was starting to take its toll on him. Obviously, the neck injury was worse than any of it, but I do think by just knowing his work ethic, we would have had some fantastic matches in 1998, 1999 in a different way than what we got. Austin still, I think, would have risen to the top. Like, I don't think any of that would have changed, but I do think the style of match that we got from a Steve Austin would have been a little bit different. But probably, I don't know that he would be in as good a shape today, because I think his body would have just slowly broken down over time, and probably he would have been hurting by 1999 or 2000 anyway, just knowing the level that he always wanted to perform at.
Chris?
Yeah, it also still would have been big, but it would have been sooner. You know, the momentum was carrying, you know, was carrying over even more, and who knows, you know, he was on the poster for that pay-per-view. I mean, his face was featured on the Ground Zero poster. So that's who they were promoting for, and the tagline was, that's the bottom line.
So, I mean, yeah, definitely, and that's a show that he wasn't even on. So, you know, he did get the run in at the end, at the end of one of the matches involving Owen and Bulldog. But if he wrestled on that show, would he have wrestled Brett instead of the Patriot? Or what would they have done? You know, of course they were doing Michaels and Undertaker. But would they have done Brett and Austin?
And have Austin lose again?
The title?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it makes you wonder, you know, where it would have went after that, because, you know, he went on the Bad Blood show, if I'm not mistaken. He went on that show. I think he didn't make his next appearance till was it Survivor Series?
Yeah, he had a match at Survivor Series where he beat Owen in like
Series.
2 minutes because he was still pretty beat up.
Yeah, he beat Owen in 4 minutes. That's right. Yeah. So
Who knows? But the thing is,
how would they have done the Vince deal? You know, would that still have been the same thing? It was kind of cooler because he was hurt and he did that. I don't know. We'll never know, but yeah, it's definitely something you shouldn't talk about.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it's kind of weird to say, but if you look at WWF TV in 1998, they turned around the company through bait and switch tactics. they promised Austin matches and then coming up with reasons not to deliver them after they would hype them and hype them and hype them. And like, it sounds weird, but that, I mean, they basically just kept baiting and switching until it worked. But the thing is, they wouldn't have had to have baited and switched so much because Austin would have been able to have TV matches regularly. And so, yeah, from that point of view, it may not have worked as well. Maybe Austin would have been on top sooner, but maybe it would have taken longer for them to overtake WCW. Like, a lot of things I think would have been different.
All right. And then on the other end of the spectrum, what happened if that didn't happen and Owen, where would Owen have been? Because you still would have had Brett leaving, so I don't know. What could you have done with Owen? What would Owen change his fate? You'd have some matches with Austin, I assume. But outside of that, you think you'd probably end up where he was, Charles?
Owen probably would have had a tough time in the short term because Shawn was still around. But
that's true.
And if you see their match at the end of 97, Shawn wrestled Owen on Raw, and Shawn was hitting him with real punches. Which Brett actually talked about in his book. So, I mean, there was still definitely some animosity there, and Shawn did hold a lot of it against Owen. So I think he would have been hurt in the short term, but he's a guy who, you know, but The Rock also, I mean, as long as Shawn was around, The Rock wasn't going to be over on top either. So when Shawn left, I think Owen might have had a chance to rebound a little bit. He probably would have had some pay-per-view main events with Steve Austin. And, I think his career might have turned out a little bit differently. In fact, I think he might have been a little bit more protected at that point, which would mean that he wouldn't have been put in a position to do that stunt. You could even say that.
I think Owen pretty much would have been the same. In the long run, I really do. Brett leaving was going to happen, pretty much regardless. I think. I mean, I don't think there was any way that wasn't going to happen. And he was, you know, even though I talk about, you know, how the whole thing with Austin hurt Owen, the Brett thing hurt Owen even worse. So
yeah.
I think he just would have been screwed no matter what, which is sad, but that's the way it was.
Yeah, he actually might have been the corporate champion instead of Foley, so that might have hurt Foley somehow going into 98. But there's a lot of speculation you can do there.
I mean, I could even hear Jim Ross saying, after everything that Mr. McMahon has done to Owen Hart's family, he's going to side with him? Like, I could hear that being, like, kind of where they went with a feud like that.
Yeah, for sure. The other main talking point I wanted to bring up was about the importance of the IC title. Like, here you had Steve Austin, who was your hottest, you know, kind of new star you had, and he was in the semi-main of the show going for the IC title. And what I find interesting about that is, like, nowadays, you have someone like Roman Reigns who could be in the semi-main of the show going for the IC title if the IC title was still important, instead of failing in title matches every show, which, you know, might end up hurting him in the long run, because he's, this is what, two shows in a row he's failed at being the world champion in title matches. And if he was kept away from that, and if the IC title is a little more important, you know, that could be more of his focus. What do you think the death, like, the IC title unimportance, what do you think about all that there, Charles?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you said.
And back then, the IC title was a stepping stone belt for a lot of guys. So you knew when the guy was winning the IC title, more often than not, he was going to be world champion sooner than later. You know, yeah, there were examples of the other way, but Shawn, Bret, Warrior, you know, all those guys, you know, had their, you know, that was their springboard to success. So, yeah, and it's also another thing about this show is how differently the show was structured compared to how it is now. Because the show was structured where the matches were layered to build to the main event. And it wasn't the thing where you had big, strong opener, then weak match. Strong match, weak match. And then there wasn't a buffer match between the two main matches. You had one, the semi-main event, then you had the main event. So, yeah, there was structure different than what it is now as well.
Yeah, it's, yeah, this is the two ways to looking at it, right? You can build your show up, or you can have peaks and valleys. And, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages to both. I kind of like this way where the show gets more important throughout, but the way they're doing it nowadays isn't horrible. Charles?
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, we talked before about the you know, someone agreeing to do something, or if they win or lose the match, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So, yeah, I think it was all part of a way to enhance the main event. So I agree with that.
Yeah, the main event was the thing. So I think we can move on now to the main event, which was The Undertaker versus Bret Hart with Shawn Michaels as the referee. All right, and if Bret doesn't win the title, he can never wrestle in the States again. And if Shawn Michaels shows favoritism towards Undertaker, then he can never wrestle in the States again. I think I got all that right.
Yeah. And that was a funny thing watching the video before this match, where you saw where Bret, where he said that, and then Vince, like, called him out on it. Because Bret said, he mistakenly said it, because he meant to say it another way, like if he won the match, he would never come back to the United States. And he actually said if he lost. And then Vince said, so if you lose, you're not wrestling in the United States again? And Bret, you know, was like, what? he messed up, and Vince called him on. And then Shawn, the whole Shawn deal, you know, where he did the same thing, and it, I don't know. It added something to the whole thing, and it makes sense in the end. But it's kind of odd that the referee has the stipulation in the match, too. And usually, if that happens, Mexico, that happens, they have to put the hair on the line. You know, this one, you know, this what I guess you can say he's put his career on the line in a way, but it's just odd that the referee had the stipulation as well.
Yeah, and watching the build-up video to the match, it almost seemed like The Undertaker, the champion, the guy in the match, was a complete second thought, and it was all about HBK and Bret. What do you think, Charles?
And they were also starting to build, you know, they were starting the Kane stuff, yeah. And Paul Bearer came out during the match looking just like Buddy Wayne. it is amazing the similarity between Paul Bearer at the time and Buddy Wayne. It was a spinning image. And those of you don't know Buddy Wayne, is Buddy Wayne was Nightmare King Wayne's dad, and he worked in Memphis forever. And one of the great promos who nobody talks about because he rarely cut promos, but he was a guy that, go on YouTube, and he managed King and the Ultimate Warrior when they were the Freedom Fighters in Memphis, and watch him do promo work with them. But that had that storyline going on. So yeah, Undertaker was it was just a weird dynamic in this match. It's like the match was all about Bret Shawn. Oh, and here's the Undertaker.
And the Undertaker had his own big storyline going on, like you said, with the Kane thing. That started way back in, like, the day after WrestleMania. So this storyline's been building, too. So you have all these weird things going on together, and I guess you're paying to see what happens between Shawn and Bret, but it's weird, the whole dichotomy there. What do you think, Charles?
Well, I was looking at some of the stuff that led to this match, and I think my favorite segment, and this, it was actually one of my favorite segments of 1997, was when Bret found out that Shawn was the referee, and him and Vince got in that fight. That looked so real. Vince was fantastic in that, because his face, I mean, he looked so shaken up, and he was so mad, and he wanted, you could tell he wanted to take a swing at Bret, but knew he couldn't do it. That was seriously brilliant, like everything about that. But yeah, I do think that this match was built basically promising a title change. It's just, how are they going to get to that point? That was almost the way that they were presenting it. Like, yeah, Undertaker is obviously going to move on to something else. Bret is obviously going to win the title, but you're going to have to pay to see how we're going to get there. You're going to have to pay to see how how we get to a point of Shawn Michaels counting the 1-2-3 for Bret to win the title. And so, yeah, in the match, I thought it really was, like, more about the Bret-Shawn interplay than it was the Undertaker. And I thought the match was good. I think they had a better match at One Night Only 6 weeks later. Far better, actually. But this was... actually, there were a lot of similarities between the two matches. The difference, the biggest difference, I think, is that this one is a lot longer. It has a lot of the extraneous storyline stuff, and so it feels a little bit more bloated. But it still is really good and well worked. I think the finish is one of the best in terms of setting things up. It's one of the best finishes to a main event on a pay-per-view that I can recall, where not just in the sense that, okay, they gave you a finish, but in the sense that they set up so many things by doing that. I think there's some irony to this in the sense that Bret winning the title was the beginning of him no longer being the top guy. Because at that point he was, like, phased down immediately. I'm sure that we'll talk about, like, the aftermath a little bit later, so I'll hold off on that for now. But it went a little long, but I think it was a really good match that definitely had its moments. And I actually felt sympathetic. If I transplant myself back to how I felt at the time, I felt sympathetic to Shawn because I felt like he was put in a no-win situation, although I didn't understand why he didn't just hit Bret too, because then he's not showing favoritism. He hit both guys with a chair shot. So that was one thought that crossed my mind at the time.
Yeah,
I thought Shawn was the MVP of the match. His whole performance in that match was so good. The job of refereeing, he was a really good referee. You know, he hit all the spots right. He wasn't too over the top in trying to stop Bret. And he was equal to the Undertaker. He was trying to stop him too. And everything he did in that match was really, really strong. Bret was hitting all the spots. You know, he was doing the stuff around the post, the figure four, then the sharpshooter around the post, and he did a really good job working over the Undertaker. The match built fine. I agree that the rematch was better, but then the finish was pretty fantastic. because you know, Brett brought the chair in the ring and used it on the Undertaker, and Shawn just happened to see the chair, you know, and it's like, did you use this? And Brett's like, no, I didn't use this. So why did it get in there? And Brett's like, I don't know. And Shawn's like, well, you know, you can use his chair, and then arguing on all this other stuff. And then Shawn, the way Shawn hit the Undertaker with the chair by mistake was done really well. It, you know, it was so fluid in how it was done, where you could believe, oh man, he fucked up and hit this guy by my mistake. It wasn't this thing where, oh, he meant to hit him actually as well, to prove that he's not showing favoritism. And then he was conflicted, he showed his emotion, and then when he counted the pinfall, the way he did it, where he got in Brett's face and was looking him eye to eye as he counted the Undertaker out, like, you fucking asshole. I cannot believe that I'm doing this to save my career. Because that's why he did it, was he was saving his own career. So Shawn is in this position where I got to look out for me. You know, sure, am I screwing the Undertaker? Yeah. But I got to have my career too. So I got to count you out, buddy. And then, you know, you just start walking off afterwards. And they played it up big time. That's one thing I give him credit for. They played it up bigger than what it actually was. Because it didn't come off, you know, the way it was done was like Shawn was turning heel. But damn it, they didn't go that hard on commentary about, you know, Shawn doing that. So they did a great job of presenting that, and Undertaker won that after him and stuff. But then you had the fans throwing trash in the ring, at, you know, and Brett celebrating with a title, which, you know, you didn't see a whole lot of in WWF that time, except in this angle. And it was all just a cool setup there.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the match too. It was one of those. I kind of like the matches that slowly build. Like, there's a lot of matches that go on where you kind of have to keep the crowd excited at all times. While this match was like, okay, we're gonna work on the knee. We're gonna build up towards the more exciting things later on, and I always enjoy that. I wanted to talk about Shawn Michaels as a referee. Because this is, I guess, his first time as a special referee, but he becomes a special referee so many times throughout the years. After his injury, you know, after his career, all these things. But first thing I want to talk about is his outfit, which, you know, white socks with black pants. And I really liked that his wrist tape was striped like a referee.
At least he wore pants. The next time he refereed was the beginning of the short shorts, where he was doing his he was wearing shorts that were about the length of Hector Garza's tights. I mean, at least he had pants on.
Yeah, that's a positive. I liked one point he looks at Taker and he's like, "Look at my wrist tape. I'm the authority here." Instead of looking at his shirt,
"I'm the law. I am the law."
Yeah. So, the thing about this, though, yeah, he was pretty good in this match, but later on, like, I've always hated him as a special referee, so this is his standout performance here. What do you think, Charles?
Yeah, Shawn was great during all of this. And I actually, Jim Ross, I thought, hit it a little bit too hard. I thought he hit the angle a little bit too hard instead of saying, what was that all about? Like, the whole "I don't buy that" like made it seem like Shawn had planned to hit Undertaker the entire time.
Yeah,
with the chair.
Way too long.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't like that. I thought he oversold it a little bit.
Yeah, it was kind of like Bobby Heenan with when Hogan came out for the NWO turn. He's like, "What side is he on?" Kind of one of those lines. It felt like where it kind of laid the things out a little too much, maybe.
But if we're going to talk about lines in the match, Jerry Lawler had the line of this match where he talked about Shawn Michaels is one of these guys where if he goes to the funeral, he's upset because he's not the cat. That is a great line.
That was a good line. What else in this match? Oh, yeah, the sharpshooter around the ring post. That I think that's one of the things. Brett had an idea, and he tried it, and then he never did it again because it looked so weird. But
yeah,
it was nice to see. So I guess we'll kind of move on to a little bit after this match. Like, it's kind of weird that this is a show where it's kind of all built around the Hart Foundation. They're in four of the matches. They have all stipulations on. They walk out, and Bret Hart's the five-time champion. And this show was really kind of like the death of the Hart Foundation, because they were just completely shift down the card from here. So it's a very weird thing where it seems like a show is built all around one thing, and coming out of it, it's not at all. Any thoughts on what happened with the Hart Foundation going forward, Chris?
Well, it was all tied to Brett. You know, the more and more Brett was threatening the league, why should we push this faction? Because, I mean, the leader's going to be gone, and then you have the unfortunate Pillman death, and everything just started adding up. I mean, they had their peak with them at the Canadian Stampede show. I mean, that was the moment that they wanted and got out of that. And everything after that wasn't going to be as good. So, yeah, they were going to have their, you know, DX was going to be the new thing. So the Hart Foundation had to be defaced. So that was what was going to happen.
I think if you look at Brett, the pay-per-view, there's a clear difference if I remember right. I'm not looking at the numbers right now. But wasn't there a clear difference between pay-per-views that Brett headlined in 1997 and pay-per-views he didn't in terms of the buy rate? Like, he was a definite draw in the sense that when he was around, things were much better than they were when he wasn't. And I think that in the case of Shawn Michaels, I mean, when you watch all the week-to-week TV, Shawn is much better at getting heat on himself. But I think Brett was better at getting over feuds. I think Shawn worked better as a top heel in the sense that people had been dying to boo him. And, you know, like, he was probably the most universally loathed heel that I've ever seen in WWE in terms of fan hatred. I've never seen anything like that in that company. Brett didn't have that, I think, because even though people were booing Brett because he was making anti-American comments, Brett was still respected, and I don't think people ever really wanted to boo him. They just felt like they had to because of what he was saying, or because of what he was doing. You know, like, it wasn't that there was a fan demand there to boo Brett like there was to boo Shawn. So Shawn, I wish Shawn had been better at building up the interest in his feuds. I mean, he did with Undertaker for sure. But I felt like Brett, like, if you look at the week-to-week stuff, Shawn usually every week was a guy who got the upper hand. And then he would go to the pay-per-view match and he would win. Brett was a guy who would sometimes get the upper hand and sometimes not. And it would kind of go back and forth a little bit more, so the feuds were more interesting because it wasn't just the heels, like, dominating everything every week. And I don't know if that was them trying to copy the NWO or if that was Shawn insisting on never, like, letting anyone get the best of him. I'm not really sure what that was. Maybe both.
Oh, yeah. It was totally Shawn being Shawn. I mean, that was the mentality at the time. You know, I'm protecting my spot. I'm not going to do anything that I don't approve of. So, and I don't think that's a job. So, that was all Shawn at the time. But then with Brett was, I think, Brett's strongest antagonist was Austin, as far as to the fans. Because Austin was the guy the fans wanted to cheer. Undertaker was Undertaker. You know, he had that respect and stuff, but he wasn't, like, the fan favorite, you know, the huge fan favorite. And then Shawn, you know, of course, was as polarizing as it got. So if Brett's not in there against Austin and, you know, try to put him against the Patriots, and that didn't really work, and there was no other really strong face in the company. That's why if they would have done Shamrock right, Shamrock could have been that guy. But they dropped the ball in that regard. So if Brett didn't have a strong babyface figure, you know, Austin really wasn't babyface, but if he had that strong figure that connected to the band, then, yeah, it wasn't going to be the same.
Yeah, something else I would add is that it's easy, just because WWF TV was so good in 97, it's easy to look back on, like, what led to the Attitude Era and think that it was this planned, mapped out thing, when I think the result of the main event shows that, like, they just kind of lucked into it all.
Because, oh, yeah.
Because why like, it's like they put the title on Brett, and then 6 weeks later, Vince decides he needs to leave the company.
Yeah, what the hell?
So obviously that wasn't in his mind at this point, or if it was, it wasn't serious. But 6 weeks later was when he actually approached Brett about breaching his contract. So it's just weird to me that, it's just a lot of desperation tactics over and over. But if you look back, they kind of have an ongoing theme. And I think it's just coincidence.
They got lucky with Austin, you know, catching fire. If Austin didn't catch fire, who knows what that company would have done? I mean, their future is tied. Their future was tied to Austin, and let's say if Austin would have got hurt earlier. Well, let's say if he would have got that neck injury in the Mania match with Brett, and they couldn't follow up on that. That would have been a big time blow to that company.
Chris, is it true that Vince, like, at least, like, even after turning him at WrestleMania, Vince really wasn't that high on Austin?
Yeah, he didn't think that he was he wasn't the material to be the top guy in the company. I think Vince saw him as that second tier at best. He could main event some, but he wasn't on the level of Bret, Shawn, or Undertaker. You know, and you got to remember, this was the same guy that thought Sid Vicious was that guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, his judgment, you know, at that time definitely was not that good. It was the people that was below him that was, you know, pushing Austin, like Ross and Cornette and people like that. And, you know, and then the crowd. The crowd was the big factor. If the crowd hadn't got behind him, then who knows?
Well, I don't know if and you guys remember this, but the night after WrestleMania, they announced the In Your House card for the upcoming month, and one of the matches announced was Bret vs. Sid. So I don't even know what they would have done with Austin at that point, but luckily Sid got injured or went to softball or whatever he did, and Austin stepped in there. But yeah, it's clearly. And then Austin got the title match against Taker and lost like the next month. So it was clear they didn't think he was the top guy going forward. What I wanted to ask was, say the injury here for Austin was worse, and he couldn't come back. Like, he had a situation where that was the end of his career. What would they have done? Would they ended up with Ken Shamrock, or what do you think, Charles?
They would have been in a terrible state, because not only would they have not have had Austin, but they would have lost Bret Hart, and 6 months later they would have lost Shawn Michaels. So that's a lot to lose at one time. They probably would have had no choice but to run Undertaker Mankind on top for a long time, and Undertaker Kane, obviously, because they'd brought Kane in. And I really don't know what they would have done beyond that. I think, you know, something else that's interesting that's kind of a what-if to throw into all this, and this is something that's forgotten. I don't know how serious it ever got. Chris, maybe you can elaborate on this, but Hulk Hogan was talking to the WWF about returning in early 1998. And I remember there were a lot of rumors surrounding that Hogan was about to return. And I think Vince at one point seemed to think that he could get him. But that's something interesting to try to throw into this also. I think maybe if that had happened, Vince would have thrown everything he had that he could possibly offer to get Hogan away from WCW.
Yeah, he would have. We just lost Chris for a second. I'm just calling him back. But
Verizon ring back tone while your party is free.
Oh, this is great. I love Chris's ringtone. Hey, you want to repeat your question there, Charles?
Yeah, Chris, how serious did the WWF talks in early 1998 get as far as signing Hogan?
I think there was a movement there. I don't think it was as serious, though, as the Savage the year earlier in 96.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was more serious than Hogan was. Yeah, Vince always had in mind to bring Hogan back, of course. I mean, that was always going to happen eventually, somehow, some way. But I just don't think at that time Hogan would have went back. I think he had his run of the mill in WCW. He could do whatever he wanted. why would he want to leave that? So, yeah, I don't think it was probably, you know, some friendly conversation and stuff like that, but I don't think it was anything that serious.
You know, and even Vince, I mean, for all the talk about how they wanted to push new stars and how WCW was like stars from a previous generation, Vince brought back Big Boss Man. But more than that, he also, and this is kind of forgotten, he wanted, I mean, Earthquake was repackaged as Golga, but he wanted Earthquake to come in as a top heel to feud with Steve Austin.
He did?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what made him change his mind, but originally that was the plan, was to bring him back as Earthquake and do Austin versus Earthquake on top.
I think it's Vince Russo. I think Vince Russo stopped more of Vince's, you know, deal about pushing old guys or anything else. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. Russo had his issues, but Russo was all about pushing, you know, the new guys more than anything else. So, and that's why he got so popular among the talent. It's because of that, because he was not afraid to give these guys chances to get over. You know, even though a lot of this stuff was horrible in ways, but I mean, the dude was a success, and that company was fresher than WCW was at that time by leaps and bounds, at least on the top part of the card. So, if he didn't have anybody to filter him out, now it's about McMahon and Russo both. They filtered each other out, I think, as much as, you know, there was always that talking point that McMahon filtered Russo. Well, I think Russo filtered out McMahon too, in a lot of ways. He stopped Vince from doing some crazy stuff. Where today, you know, I don't know if Vince has that filter, although he really doesn't, you know, do as much as he used to, but still he's surrounding himself with yes men. That it's kind of hard for you know, for somebody to stop him from doing whatever he wants. But,
I think another key there is Austin was one of those guys who would not do some of the crap, I'm sure, proposed to him. He seems like a guy who was like, that's stupid. I'm not going to do that. So there was another kind of third filter going on there as well.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And we would see that later on with Brock, you know, with the whole thing where he refused to do the job for Brock Lesnar. I mean, he got this so comfortable in his character, his gimmick, that he, you know, much as we talk about Shawn, you know, how he was, you know, talking about how he wanted to protect himself, also did the same thing. And it makes sense in a way, you know, if you're doing it right, you know, you want to make sure that you're protected, because if you're over and you're the money guy in the company, you don't want to be made look like a fool. And God knows, if there were guys in WCW that felt more like that in the good way and not the Kevin Nash type of way, then who knows what would happen in that company. If Goldberg would have come out and said, I'm not going to do this bullshit finish in Starcade 98. So, you know, who knows what would happen.
Yeah, this seems like, looking back at this period, and if you're just looking at the SummerSlams, like, the amount of what-ifs and speculations and just, like, intrigue into a certain time period at the time, like, this SummerSlam has got to be one of the most interesting, if not the best, like, not the best show to watch, but definitely one of the most interesting to think about and talk about and speculate about. But any kind of other thoughts do you have about this show overall and the summer of 97 with the WWF, Charles?
It was a great time to be a wrestling fan. It was kind of the point where I think everyone, and I think, well, if you look at the WWF specifically, I think the most entertaining aspect as far as a character was Steve Austin, but there was also the whole, like, Brett and Shawn really hating each other, and everyone knew that it went further than just what we saw on television. I think even your most casual fans understood that. And I think those two things, I mean, there were other good things in the company, but I think those are the two things that made this time period so fun to watch the WWF.
This show was a linchpin, I think. It was, I would say the the real beginning of what was about to happen, because now you got Sean turning, and you got Brett with a championship. You know, so he's the hottest guy, the hottest character in the company on the heel side. He's not a champ. And you have Austin winning the Intercontinental title, so now he's the number two guy in the company, even though he's hurt. And you got Foley, you know, starting to come into his own as a character. So you're positioning yourself now with these guys, and you've already set up Undertaker and Kane down the road. So the building blocks were being placed. And another thing we're talking about what ifs is what happens if Rock doesn't get hurt? How, you know, at that time before he got hurt, they were still trying to push him hard as a babyface. And if he doesn't get hurt, how does that affect him? You know, how far down does he go?
Well, and plus,
goes right to the Nation.
And even on top of that, like, he had the issues with Sean and Hunter at that point. So, it would have been interesting.
Yeah, if Austin got hurt and they didn't have The Rock, we might not see the WWF around today.
And Sean, the issues there, like, I honestly don't think that if Shawn Michaels had still been around, even with Austin rising to the top, if Shawn was still around as the top guy, I don't think that The Rock had a chance. I think Shawn needed to leave for The Rock to get over, and that's not based on talent or anything like that. That's because I think Shawn would have cut him off every chance he got.
Did Shawn have a problem with The Rock outside of the fact that The Rock was like a Bret Hart guy?
I think that was the majority of it, but also I don't know if that's when the issues with The Rock and Triple H started, kind of the rivalry that was mostly, you know, just like competition, but had its moments. So I don't know the answer to that.
I think that the Bret thing had a lot to do with it, but I think some of it had to do with Sean resenting the way this guy was being positioned as a starting out like that. I think Sean maybe saw him as a threat, which, you know, he was. And if Sean hadn't got hurt, that definitely would have changed a lot of things in that company, no doubt. I mean, I don't think Triple H would have got as big as he did to start off with, because he became now the leader at DX. Now Sean's gone, so it's and Sean definitely would get his rematch with Austin. So yeah, who knows? There's so many what ifs in that era. You know, we talk about now. Talk about what if WWE did this now and stuff like that to cut the product. But that era had more what ifs just like any era in the history of wrestling, I thought.
Yeah, on both ends, on WCW and ECW as well, because you had three legit companies on pay-per-view, and just so much stuff happening and trying to one-up each other each week. It was just it was a time of insanity, really. Luckily, you know, we have the documentary, Wrestling with Shadows, that kind of caught some of this stuff backstage. Kind of got to see some of it, which was very interesting.
Yeah.
Can you imagine Hogan's legacy if he had jumped to the WWF in early 1998? Because he would be leaving WCW right as the downfall was starting, and going to the WWF right as the turnaround was starting. So he would have been seen as the guy who you had to have around if you wanted to have a hot company. Even though both of those things may have happened with or without him, we would have looked back and said, wow, Hogan, he jumped and everything changed. You know, that would have been the perception.
Could you?
Well, think about it. He would come in, you know, they would have put him in his office. And Hogan coming back in, heel Hogan, against Austin, who was at that time at his peak as a babyface, that would have been huge money.
You imagine, like, the corporate champion McMahon brought in was Hogan, as Hollywood Hogan, as his corporate champion, in like, oh, that would have been insane time.
Yeah, it really would have been.
I can't imagine what the matches would look like, but it wouldn't have mattered, that's for sure.
No, it would not have mattered.
Yeah,
it'd been watching to print money, as I say.
Yes, it would have. Do we have anything else we can go over about this show? Chris, you any final...
One thing I want to talk about this show is the commentary on the show. How, you know, you compare it to the commentary of the day, it is just so light years ahead of what we have today. You know, Vince was still doing the Vince shtick, but you had Ross doing, you know, giving all his facts and histories and was, you know, really solid in what he did. And then Lawler, who, it's amazing to hear him then and now. Amazing. Because he was, you know, the heel then. He was still doing heel announcer. But he was so good at what he did. It's just, God, it makes you sad to hear that. And because now, you know, there's a lot of times on, especially on Raw, I'll just mute it. You know, I can't stand to listen to it anymore. So, yeah, it's just amazing to listen to commentary.
Yeah, well, one of the aspects that jumped out to me, it was during in the Austin Owen match, and Lawler's going on and on about how he wants to see Owen moon the world and have Austin kiss his butt in front of everyone. And after going on that for a while, JR goes, "You want to see another man kiss another man's butt? Like, what's wrong with you?" And Lawler, like, as quick as a whip, is like, "I want to see Austin eat his words." Like, he was so good at that time. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened to him. I mean, I don't know if it's Vince in his ear or what it is, but the commentary got progressively worse later on.
It makes a difference when the guy that's in charge is the one doing the play-by-play, because like we talked about earlier, he's getting over the angles because it's his angles. So there, you know, Bill Watts said one time, there's no bigger voice in, you know, in getting over stuff than the play-by-play guy. And if he's not the one that's in tune with the booker, if he's not the booker himself, then it's not going to be the same, because only they know what they think. It's hard, you know, you can tell somebody to say something, but coming from my lips to your lips, it's not the same thing. So, yeah, I mean, that was a big plus for that. That's why, you know, Bischoff, yeah, he wasn't the best play-by-play guy, but he knew what to say when to say it to get over his ankles, too.
I always liked when Vince did commentary, because to me, I mean, he did put everything over, but you could always tell who his favorite guys were.
Shawn Michaels?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, just, I mean, and you could say that going back pretty far. Like, I always could tell that Vince loved Yokozuna as a heel, loved him because of how much he put over his bumps. Like, just little things like that have always fascinated me, just listening to Vince talk. And there were a few other guys like that, but Yokozuna's one that stands out a lot.
Yeah, Shawn, before he became an ass, that, you know, listen to, you know, Vince, especially like the you know, the WrestleMania, you know, match with Brett, the Iron Man match, and all that stuff, and just,
even, you know, even Brett, I think Vince genuinely loved Bret Hart as his top guy. I really do. I think he always, in the back of his mind, thought, until something better comes along, but I think I really do think that there was some respect for Brett there that kind of came through in his commentary most of the time, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And also his love of any hillbilly character. How happy he was when there was a hillbilly on the screen. He, like, lost his shit. He's like, oh, my God, they got pigs. Like, he was the happiest man on earth. You talk about booking for Vince, like... There's nothing more booking for Vince than having the Godwins and Hillbilly Jim out there dancing with a pig.
Can you imagine a farting hillbilly that had a blonde valet?
Oh boy! Okay,
it is kind of amazing. They did try to do that with Sonny, though. You know, they did put her with them for a little bit, but it was surprising that they never put, you know, like a straight up blonde country chick with the Godwins at that time area, with the Daisy Dukes on and all that stuff. Go full, you know, stereotype with that.
They should have had Debbie Malenko do it. Can you imagine?
Oh,
what?
Oh boy. Okay. I we'll go around for final thoughts now. Charles.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else to say. Just interesting show, more than it is a good one, and like I said at the beginning, more interesting to watch in retrospect than it probably was at the time.
Chris?
Yeah, the same thing. You know, we pretty much did everything, you know, while we did the show. It was definitely better than them, Road Wild. That's no brainer. Although maybe not as good as Hardcore Heaven, but in the month of August 1997, it was, you know, a good show.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess, Charles, just let everyone know how to get in touch with you, your Twitter, and anything else you got going on.
You can follow me on Twitter at ProRes, WRES only. And you can find our message board at ProWrestlingOnly.com. Do not use the function on the website to create an account. If you want a membership, please send an email to PWOmembership@gmail.com. Let me know what username you want, and I will set it up for you.
And Chris, how to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter at Chris Zellner, KRSCELLNER. You know, I already talked about earlier about Lucha Force. And let me say something about Force now. It was proven this week that John Cena loves that pool. So that tells you right there that that on board is the premier message board in the wrestling internet. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, there's a thread on the board about turning John Cena heel. And he tweeted out something almost exactly just like that thread starts out as. You know, the world would be better if I turned heel or whatever. So it's a proven fact to keep up that board.
Well, it is probably the best wrestling message board. Well, not probably. It is the best wrestling message board out there. So I suggest everyone go out there and join up. Just the way Charles said. And you can find me on Twitter at Stephen Graham TWS. Stephen with a V, Graham like the cracker, TWS. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us, and thank Charles and Chris for being on the show. And you guys can check out other editions of the SummerSlam Rewind here at Place to Be Nation coming up. Thank you.